Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent at The Nation magazine. We're first going to look through a legal lens at Trump's obstruction of an effective transition, then at the question of how difficult it's going to be for Biden to reverse Trump's executive orders and rules, and finally, we'll talk about the Supreme Court. And you can learn more about Ellie's work at thenation.com. That's thenationoneword.com. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. Just let me say, as we confront the surging coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you all to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. As justice correspondent for The Nation magazine, Ellie Mistal covers the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics, as well as writing the monthly column, Objection. He's a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law, and he was for 12 years the executive editor of Above the Law. As I said, we're going to look at the obstacles Trump is placing in the way of an effective transition at this moment when the nation faces multiple crises, the relentless COVID-19 pandemic, the deep and sustained crippling of the economy resulting in massive red ink for businesses and massive unemployment for people, and the recognition by many that it is high time to reckon with systemic racism and reimagine law enforcement, criminal justice, and prisons. We know there's little a Biden administration can do about the numerous young, Federalist Society-supported right-wing judges Trump has appointed, not just to the Supreme Court, but throughout the federal court system. The horrendous tax bill of 2017, in which most of the benefits go to the wealthy and to corporations, and through which the deficit has ballooned even before the pandemic, led to a crash and called for enormous new government spending. Well, that's going to be impossible to do anything about unless we get two wins in the Georgia runoffs and give the Democrats rule of the Senate. But how much can Biden reverse the many executive orders and federal rules that Trump has signed over the last few years and how he's accomplished most of his damage? And then, finally, even before the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her replacement by Amy Coney Barrett, Mistal thought of the Supreme Court term as, quote, truly terrifying. So what's on tap for this session? And how bad might a 6-3 right-wing court make things? Welcome, Ellie Mistal, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thank you for having me, Terrence.
Great. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, November 16th. So first, about the election. Where do we stand legally with regard to Trump's attempts to stall or overturn election results?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like wading through the trash, right? Like, you're going to take the trash out to the curb eventually, but right now it's kind of just like filling up in your house, and you gotta like actually like put it in a bag, and I'm being flipped, but that's the best way to think of these lawsuits. They're not serious, okay? They fall generally into three categories. One, you have various allegations that the Trump poll watchers either weren't in the room, which they were, that's a lie that they weren't, or weren't close enough to observe the tabulating of mail-in ballots, right? That's one category of lawsuits. Second category, you have some issues with certain Trump supporters or Trump voters alleging that they had problems voting because of various kind of Scantron mistakes or accidents or whatever. They see vast conspiracies. It's a couple of mistakes. And that's kind of the second category of lawsuits. And the third category, which kind of could have been serious, are basically the Republican Party and the Trump administration arguing that people who follow the rules should have their votes thrown away. So those are that's the 30,000 foot level. The poll watcher issue, it's just not a real issue. Because the solution for that, and this, Terrence, I would say to your listeners, is how you should think of every lawsuit that you see. What is the remedy that they're asking for, right? Because if the re 'cause the for Trump to overturn the election, what he needs to do is throw out tens of thousands of legal votes that were cast in a timely manner, right? If the remedy that the Trump administration is asking for doesn't involve throwing out votes, well, then you can just basically disregard the lawsuit. It's not important. If the remedy does require them to throw away votes, well, then you can feel fairly confident that lawsuit is going nowhere. So that's how people should understand it. To get back to the three categories, the poll watchers, not important. The remedy for that is to count ballots with poll watchers closer. That's what they'll do, I imagine, in some of these recounts that are happening. That's fine. Recounts rarely change more than 1,000 votes. It would be unprecedented for a recount to change even 5,000 votes, and Trump is down by more than 5,000 in all the states that are recounting. So, whatever. The Scantron mistakes, the Benghazi, as I like to call it, the people, the Sharpie, and whatever. The remedy for that is to count their votes if they didn't get counted, right? So that's like a couple hundred more votes for Trump. Yay! The third category, which is what I was worried about before the election, is this kind of Brett Kavanaugh special, this idea that votes that were mailed in before Election Day but received after Election Day should not count. That's a potential Supreme Court issue, because Brett Kavanaugh and the other conservatives have indicated a willingness to throw away those votes in the election. And they shouldn't. Those votes should be counted. But as it turns out, Biden won by enough margin. There's a small enough, those votes represent a very small percentage of Biden's overall lead. We're talking about, I think it was, I saw one report that was like around 8,000 to 10,000 votes in Pennsylvania when Biden is up by 45,000 votes. So even kind of worst case scenario that the courts decide to throw away those votes, even throwing away all of those votes aren't going to make up the difference for Trump.
Okay, so, let me jump in for a second then. A couple of things I wanted to say. One is that, so it sounds like, since you're saying that, we all said, okay, Biden's going to win by a landslide or they'll find a way to steal it. It sounds like, A, he won by a large enough margin, and B, that when you're saying that the number of votes that would be subtracted if they didn't count the votes that arrived, that were mailed on time but arrived after Election Day, it would not be enough to change it. It sounds like people also did do their, they listened and they voted early.
Exactly. That's one of the, one of the weird things is that, Trump is basically suggesting conspiracy because the mail-in ballots went against him so heavily, which is a weird thing for him to allege, because he was the one telling his own people not to mail in the votes, not to take the coronavirus seriously, to go on Election Day. So, of course, his voters disproportionately followed his advice and showed up on Election Day. Biden voters disproportionately followed Biden's advice and mailed their votes in early. Of course, we were going to see this kind of split. There's no deep, dark conspiracy right there. It's people following instructions.
Yep. I mean, I'm so impressed that they did that. But by the way, I always thought that that wasn't, like, why is he telling his voters to do that? I thought what he wanted was exactly what did happen, that his voters would be in the same day voting, and so these big percentages would show up, and so he would then, because they were such big percentages, claim there must be something going on there. So I
exactly
always,
and if the election was closer, as we've said, I think I've said on your program before, if this election was close, they were gonna find a way to steal it, and this was how they were gonna do it.
That's right.
But it wasn't close.
That's
it
right.
It wasn't close.
And so the last thing, my sort of question is, so do we have anything still to worry about? Was the stalling piece, that if they can gum up the works enough, that maybe then a couple, then they could claim that the voice of the people was not clear, that recounts didn't happen in time, like why they're doing a full hand recount in Georgia and so on. Is any of that something to be feared at this point? The stalling, getting them to the, we better choose electors because the choice of the voters isn't clear.
Not really.
Good.
Like,
good.
it's just not, it's for the Supreme Court to do that. Again, the way that rules work are that the states have broad authority to choose how they will choose electors. But they have to make a determination on how they're going to choose the electors by election day, right? You can't bait and switch it, right? So if you show up to vote for Biden, what you're really doing is showing up to vote for a slate of Biden electors. Mm-hmm. For Pennsylvania to change that rule after you voted is illegal. It's just not. There's an actual statute saying that you can't do that unless the voters fail to make a choice. That's why you're talking about what you're talking about.
That's right.
This issue of delaying it to make it seem like the vote, but like this, you'd have to find 5 Supreme Court justices to accept that logic. And that's unlikely even with this overly conservative Supreme Court. And then the other thing that I've been telling people to kind of calm them, you don't just have to do that in one state.
That's right.
Trump needs to do this in 3 states. You need to take Pennsylvania and two of either Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, or Michigan. Or Georgia, right?
Or Georgia.
You need to take 2 of those 3,
right.
Through those 5 states, in addition to doing this in Pennsylvania, which is just, it's just a hard, I can't say it's impossible, because, you know, I'm old enough to remember when this Access Hollywood tape came out, and I thought, well, that's it, right?
So, right, right. The number of times we thought this is impossible, yes.
Right. So I don't want to say it's impossible, but it is highly improbable.
So one of those keys in those that are further along the authoritarian continuum than we are at this moment, part of it is that they get not just judges who lean their way, but they get judges who are either corrupt or intimidated enough to do their bidding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's definitely part of their plan. But again, you have to. One of the nice things, I guess, if you want to put it this way, about lifetime appointments is that these people have to think about their careers and their basically legitimacy over a much longer period of time than Trump is likely to be here trying to end American democracy, right? So when you look at a person like Amy Coney Barrett, your question is really, you know, does she want her first major decision on the court to be to end American democracy? Really? I mean, she's going to be there for 40 years. Is this how she wants to come out of the gate? So I'm not, again, it's not impossible. These people often act in bad faith, and they are often hacks for the Republican agenda. It's just hard to see how they get to 5 votes for this at the Supreme Court level.
Yeah.
One more thing, Terrence. It's even the court, even Kavanaugh, and I'm using Kavanaugh as an example of the most extreme position on this, although that most extreme position is probably actually Clarence Thomas. He just doesn't like to talk as much.
That's right.
But even these kind of hardcore Republicans have indicated that they would be disinclined to weigh in unless weighing in was dispositive in the election. So again, when you talk about all this stuff they're throwing against the wall in Pennsylvania, it's just Pennsylvania. They got to find a way to do this in 2 other states. And it's unlikely the court would weigh in just Pennsylvania when they know that it's likely going to be in a losing battle anyway.
Ah, right. So it sounds like, let me just go back before you said, so what's the remedy? It sounds like that question is also sort of related to this question, which is a decision sufficient to change anything?
Right. Right. And the court seems disinclined to, again, kind of risk its standing and reputation for a case that isn't even going to change anything.
Right.
That isn't going to ultimately change the outcome of the election. There's no upside, if you will,
right,
for the court to do that. So, I mean, again, all I'm trying to do for your listeners is to show. I'm not saying, look, again, I've had some, you know, difficult nights sleeping. Like he will try everything. All I'm trying to explain is that in this position where he is trying everything, he should realistically lose everything. Every single argument he makes either shouldn't work at all or will only work in a limited fashion that won't change the outcome.
That's right.
And that's how I do sleep at night. That's what I go to bed reminding myself.
Right. And by the way, those of you, I mentioned that you can learn more about Ellie's work at thenation.org. And you actually had an article they can find there, which is the conversation you have with yourself to get yourself to sleep, which involves a lot of what we've talked about so far. There, by the way, one point you make quite well, and I'm going to read a quote from you, which is, so what's this all about? You know, we know about Trump's insecurities. We know about, you know, he's going to hold his breath till he's blue in the face until somebody lets him stay in office or something. We know all that. But you point out, and I'm going to read your quote, and there's also the grift. Trump's campaign is broke. They've literally written checks they can't cash. Trump doesn't like spending his own money on these things to the extent he actually has any. These lawsuits purportedly challenging the election are, in fact, a huge money-making opportunity for the Trump campaign. Lay that out a little more specifically.
So in the world of there's always a tweet, when Jill Stein made the Wisconsin recount after 2016, Trump tweeted, this is just a money-making opportunity for Jill Stein. So he knows what the rift is, right? The Trump campaign has debts. They have debts they need to retire. We know that by the end, their cash flow was at a minimum, right? All of these election lawsuits have been supported by various fundraising emails from the Trump campaign to his supporters to help them stop the steal. That's their little slogan. When you read the fine print, what it says is that 60% of the donations will go to retiring campaign debt, right? So if you give Trump a dollar, 60 cents of it goes not to these lawsuits. It goes towards retiring the debt. Furthermore, recounts, as people should know, have to be paid for by the campaign that requests them. So of the 40 cents that you are giving to the election lawsuits, you're not really giving it to a lawsuit. You're giving it to a recount, which I have already said is unlikely to change nearly enough votes to change anything. So all of this is just a way for the Trump campaign to pay off its own debts without Trump having to dip into his pocket. That's really... I can't emphasize enough how I don't feel a lot of sympathy for Trump supporters. I mean, they've made their choices, and I believe their choices are bad. But he's bilking them.
Yep.
He's bilking his own people in order to make money. It's again, I have long since passed the point where I can have sympathy for these people, but I wish they would notice. I wish they would stop giving this man their money.
Yeah. And by the way, in terms of the help you to sleep at night, I think that explanation should help people to sleep, because you sort of say, well, why is he doing it? And when will he stop? And all of that. He must think he's got an ace in the hole somewhere, when in fact, if it is just a money raising scheme, a fundraising scheme, as you point out, of which 60 cents of every dollar does not go to what it claims it's for. I think that helps me relax. That there's a good logic for it that has nothing to do with winning any of these lawsuits.
Exactly. Like it's in the law, you're always taught to look for the motive, right?
Yep.
The motive is money.
Yep.
It's not to win the election. It's not to end democracy. I'm sure Trump would like to still be president. I'm sure he would like to, you know, if it was easy for him to launch a military coup, I'm sure he would be up for it.
Yep.
But the real point here is to keep him flush with cash. And again, there were stories about this coming into Election Day about how broke the campaign was. You know, when people were talking about Trump's penchant for leaving his supporters out in the cold, right, for literally doing rallies, busing them to the rallies, and then not busing them back to their cars. They would have to walk miles in the cold, as they had to in Omaha, as they had to in Michigan. Part of that story was that the Trump campaign could not afford the buses both ways.
You need the video of the rally, but you hope no one sees the video of the people waiting.
Right?
To
Because
go
you
home.
can't afford, you know, to afford buses both ways. You have to pay for the buses. You have to pay for them to wait while your rally is
Yeah.
going on and then drive people. Well, they couldn't afford the back end of that. So they just paid for the buses to come in and then let the buses go because they couldn't afford it. So, like, this is
Yeah.
like Trump's chronic brokenness
Yep.
is actually an important part of his like closing argument to his people. So it makes some sense that he is now, after the election, still trying to raise money. These lawsuits are a great way of doing it. Or these,
Okay. So I think we're going to use a phrase, we're going to put that to bed.
Nice.
The question, from a legal standpoint, what sort of mischief do you fear in the remaining 2 months of a lame duck Trump Barr administration? I call it a Trump Barr rather than a Trump Pence.
Yeah, I mean, look, this was always going to be the dangerous part. Our 70 odd day lame duck period where Trump will, I don't think I'm being hyperbolic to say loot the country. Anything,
anything not nailed down,
nailed down, right? Must go, right? And that includes trying to do what they can to pigeonhole Biden into decisions and policies that he might not. And so what you're seeing in addition to the grift is, I think, an attempt to make decisions in foreign policy. We're seeing this with the resignation of Esper, perhaps with a troop drawdown in Afghanistan. What you see is an ability is trying to push Biden, just limit Biden's options upon taking office. They've continued to put judges on the court. I mean, the Senate came back from its post-election, pre-election break, and the first thing that McConnell did was not do COVID relief again, but once again put forward judges for the district court. So they're going to keep packing. They will pack judges right up until noon on January 20th. That is what the Senate does. So you're going to see a lot of these kinds of decisions that will try to limit Biden's ability to have power once he takes it. There is precedent for this. I mean, if you look at what happened in Wisconsin when they went from Scott Walker, Republican, to Tony Evers, Democrat, they did a lot to try to limit the power of the new governor.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yep. Exactly. And North Carolina did the same thing. Right.
And North Carolina did the same thing. Republicans do this all the time. Once they lose, they use the lame duck to try to cable the power of the incoming Democratic administration, so it can't do very much.
Yep. And so that's what we should expect on the federal level, where possible.
That is what should we suspect on the federal level, to the extent they can. Now, The upside is that, you know, one of the saving graces, and I've said this pretty much since 2017, one of the saving graces of the Trump administration is that it's so damn incompetent. They don't really understand power. They don't really understand how to use power. I don't think they will be as effective as they were in Wisconsin or in North Carolina. Bill Barr is very smart, but he's only one man.
Yep.
And he only controls one branch, right? The rest of them don't seem to have the felicity with power that Barr does. So they will try this. How effective they'll be is yet to be seen.
Okay, let's move to the next administration then. What sort of things do you recommend as a Biden administration justice platform, the most crucial actions, the one that should be taken immediately upon taking office? And I know that we've got to look at this two ways. One
Right.
is the long shot that the Democrats win both runoffs in Georgia, and that would mean that there would be a 50-50 tie, counting the independents who vote with the Democrats, and would give Kamala Harris the deciding vote in tie votes. So that's, I think, long shot. I mean, who knows, right? I mean,
yep.
He won Georgia by, you know, a growing majority, and obviously all the money in both parties is heading to Georgia right now. And then there's the other scenario in which they win one of those runoffs and the Republicans still have a one senator advantage.
Yeah, one or zero, right? So first for the rosy scenario, as my friend Dr. Jason Johnson likes to say, the last time Georgia had a state runoff was in 2018. There was that close election between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams barely lost. I say she got it stolen from her by Brian Kemp. But then there was a runoff to fill Brian Kemp's old job, Georgia's Secretary of State. Participation in that election dropped off 60% from what it was in the governor's race. 60%. Now, if basically black people drop off, let's say 10%, but white people in Georgia drop off 60%, we could win both runoffs. But if they don't, but if that doesn't happen, if the drop off is not racially quoted, but instead generalized, then it's a very, very long shot. If we take the Senate, if Biden is able to have a majority in the Senate, the most important thing for him to do is to secure voting rights. The lesson of this election, the lesson of the 2018 election, really the lesson of the 2016 election, is the same lesson. Republicans, since John Roberts killed the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County v. Holder in 2013, Republican state legislatures have gone out of their way to suppress the vote of especially people of color in the various states. This election proves that Biden cannot win. Democrats cannot win without the votes of people of color. So if you want to win as a Democrat, either nationally or statewide, you have to make it easier for people to vote. That is the number one task in terms of a long-term political commitment that Biden can do in his first 2 years if he controls the Senate, secure voting rights.
By the way, I want to jump in and add one thing which always strikes me. When people point out that the Roberts Court doing away with the Voting Rights Act, claiming that problem solved, no need for this anymore, when in fact they knew right. that the number one tactic of the Republican Party is voter suppression, that let's remember also that it was John Roberts who basically initiated Citizens United. So I think it's a 1-2 punch there that's enormously powerful. One, he unleashes all the funds in the world, and two, then he makes it easier to suppress the vote.
John Roberts has been an enemy of voting rights for his entire career.
Yep.
And remember, this guy rose to prominence as one of the top lawyers for George W. Bush and Bush v. Gore in 2000, which is a lawsuit all about stopping a recount of votes. His entire judicial career has been antithetical to the concept of the 15th Amendment and one man vote, one vote. It will be on his, you know, in second paragraph of his obituary, will be this this line of cases. So again, to counteract that, I would argue for a whole bunch of Supreme Court reforms, but at the very least, we have to get legislative reforms in place to secure the right to vote for as many people as possible. Note, I say people. Yes, it's very clear that Republicans' efforts to suppress the vote are targeted at people of color, at minorities, but fundamentally, when more people vote, Democrats do better.
Yeah.
So as a broad, whether you're progressive or moderate or centrist or whatever, as a broad-based democratic strategy, allowing people to vote is the single best thing you can do to advance your ability to control power. So that's if you control the Senate. If you don't control the Senate, which I feel is, you know, like as you say, Terrence, perhaps more likely. Then Biden is going to be severely limited in what he can do to executive orders. Now, we've seen the Trump administration use executive orders to their fullest extent. I mean, this is as much of an imperial presidency as we've ever had. Biden's first task needs to be to rescind many of the terrible executive orders that Trump has you know authorized, and then start making executive orders of his own, again, especially ones around the concept of securing the voting rights to the extent that's possible through EOs.
Okay, and let me delve into this one a little more. I put this on as one of the three big topics I want to talk about because I think it's something people are interested in, but one about which there's not much, there's a lot of ignorance about how easy is it to do this, how quick is it to do this, and then am I correct? There's like three different sorts of orders here. There's executive orders, that's one thing. There's rules, federal rules, which is different than executive orders, I believe. And then there's regulations, like environmental regulations, labor regulations, public health regulations, those sorts of things. Am I correct that those are three different? And I'm perfectly willing to learn that the second two overlap or something. And then do they have different levels of difficulty of reversing them and replacing them?
I generally collapse your second two into one category. There's the kind of executive orders that come out of the president's pen, and then the executive orders that essentially come out of the cabinet's pen, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the cleaner distinction that I like to make. But yes, within both of those categories, there's additional complication. Look, executive orders, executive rulemaking, executive regulations are relatively easy to overturn. They don't look easy to overturn because Trump was so incompetent at overturning them. So the standard here is called the Administrative Procedures Act, the APA. There's a whole canon of law behind it. And it basically says the president in these issues, executive orders, the executive branch, can do whatever it wants as long as they have a reason. So they can't do things for an arbitrary or capricious nature. But as long as they have a good kind of definable, legal, valid reason for overturning a rule, they can go ahead and overturn a rule. That's not hard. What's hard is that the Trump administration's reason for doing things were often either completely nonsensical or simply racist, right? So Mexicans are rapists is not a good reason to overturn the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA. It's just not, right? It's not. That's why he's had so much trouble doing it, right? DACA was made by an executive order. It can easily be overturned by a president who wants to, but you can't say that the reason why you're doing it is because you hate Mexicans. Like, that's not how the law works, right?
Right.
And so on and so forth with so many of
and
these.
And the one I remember was the census. They wanted to change the rules around the census. And when they finally got to Wilbur Ross at Secretary of Commerce, it sounded pretty much like it was for Republican politics.
Yeah. I will say, though, the census is a little bit different because this Constitution gives Congress the right to conduct the census. The Congress has delegated that right to the Commerce Department. I would argue that Congress can take it back from the Commerce Department whenever it wants. But that would be... I'd have to see what Roberts thinks about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But for the most part, the rules that they make have been made in an arbitrary and capricious fashion. So now fast forward to the Biden administration. What he cannot do on day one is simply write an order saying every order from President Trump is here. But that would be arbitrary and capricious, right? Like, he actually has to put in the work. He has to kind of go through order by order, rescinding them, and explaining why. We are rescinding the muzzle ban because it is no longer our determination that blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's what he has to put in the work, so it can't be all done on day one. But first 100 days, he should be able to rescind just about everything bad that Trump has done by EO. From the executive departments, from the executive agencies, the EPA and the DOJ and all those people, that'll take a little bit more time because when you change rules through those agencies, there's called kind of a public comment.
Right.
Period, right. You gotta say, we're about to change the rules. And then you have to let people give you feedback on why the rules should be changed. And then you have to do so. So there's more process there for like the DOJ to snap its fingers and change some of the, some of the rules that Barr has changed. Some of them, however, are just, DOJ guidance, right? The reason why we don't do consent decrees anymore, which is what we used to use for municipalities who were shown to have had racial bias in their policing. The reason why we don't do that anymore is because Jeff Sessions said, we're not going to do that anymore. So the next attorney general, whoever that is, could just say, guess what? We're doing that again.
Yeah. Good.
Right. So there are some things they can snap their fingers and start doing day one. But for the real, for the rulemaking, for the regulation making, that's going to take a little bit more time. Still, most of that should be able to be cleared out within the first year.
This is, so I mean, it's even, it was quite fascinating to me, and I hadn't really kind of pictured what is that in this transition period and the first few weeks, months of the administration. This is almost like job one. I mean, this is the thing that right now people should be sitting somewhere in Delaware or Washington writing up the reasons for order number one, order number two. I mean, it's an interesting vision that
that's what I would be doing. Look, if Biden doesn't have the Senate, he's going to have a lot to do in these first 2 years, right? And then, by the way, if Biden doesn't have the Senate coming out of this election, let's not forget the map looks pretty good for Democrats in 2022. So there is a great chance,
right,
that, you know, granted, the incoming administration generally loses seats in a midterm. But if we can buck that trend, there is a great chance that Democrats do finally take control of the Senate in 2022. So you really don't have to look at this as a Biden won't have power in the Senate for 4 years. If Biden doesn't have power in the Senate for 2 years, you could spend 2 years. I mean, just look at where
yes,
the country is right
yes.
now. It would be a good day's work to spend 2 years overturning everything bad Trump did, promulgating your own executive orders and regulations out of your office, and dealing with the coronavirus.
And
that's
and,
a pretty good 2 years.
Yeah, and fleshing out the hollowed out, you know, deep state of the State Department, the environment, the EPA, and so on, just staffing up with competent people that have either resigned or been pushed out would be another piece of that.
Restoring money to the CDC, creating a national pandemic for it. I mean, like all of these, there is a lot Biden can do in 2 years, even if Mitch McConnell blocks him at every term in terms of actual legislation.
And it seems to me that usually that midterm loss that the incumbent, that the presidential party seems to register often in after 2 years in office, is often, as in the case of Clinton, perhaps, where he had 43 Congress people who had voted for tax increases to make up for the horrible deficits that Bush left them, who lost their midterm elections. Well, if McConnell is controlling the Senate, the Democrats will have not been able to pass some of that legislation that the Republicans would run against in midterms.
Right. A lot of the midterm losses are because the incoming president has coattails. And so they sweep into office with a bunch of new members who, after 2 years, first of all, they're new members in districts maybe that they shouldn't have won in the first place.
That's right.
And so, kind of gravity catches up with them.
Well, it's what happened in Orange County here, right? I'm in Los Angeles, right? In 2018, the Democrats swept all seven congressional seats in Orange County. They lost two of them here in 2020 because they were Republican seats to begin with.
Right. That's kind of reverting to the mean. That happens a lot. B, turnout falls off the cliff, which is always a problem and something that Democrats really need to do a better job with. You know, I always say the most important election wasn't 2020 and it wasn't 2016. It was 2014. That is when Mitch McConnell got the 9 seats in the Senate to become the majority leader. And if you look at the turnout numbers for 2014 midterms, those are the lowest turnout numbers since before the war, the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we lost it, right?
By the way, funny, Ellie, is I haven't reckoned with that one. I've always pointed out 2010 because all of the energy that created that wonderful 2008 Yes We Can election, they then dropped all their organizing, let the Republicans take 2010, and then they redistricted all, you know, which yep. led to the gerrymandering. So I looked at 2010 as crucial, but I see what you're saying. 2010 was crucial in terms of state legislatures.
In 2010, Massachusetts elected a Republican to replace Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
That is why we don't have a public option. Oh, by the way. Right? So, like, the Democrats have historically, Republicans do better in midterms because yep. their voters just, it's almost like they're older, they don't got anything better to do, they always jump in and vote.
Yep.
Democrats, because our coalition is broader, it relies more on younger people, it relies more on poorer people who don't always have the wherewithal to
yep.
always be taking these breaks to go vote, especially if it's going to take you 2 or 3 hours to do so. Our participation falls off heavily in the midterms. We need to buck that for yep. 2022.
Absolutely.
But also, that goes back to where I started, Tarrant. This yep. is why voting rights are so critical, right? If you make people wait 3 hours to vote, that's going to disproportionately affect Democrats who have jobs and don't have time off of work to go vote. Like, it just, it all comes back to voting rights. And certainly it's something that we have to be laser focused on for 22 and 24.
Very good. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent at The Nation magazine. We've looked at, through a legal lens, at Trump's obstruction of the transition. We've just been looking at the agenda for the Biden administration. And now we're going to turn our attention to the Supreme Court. And you can learn more about Ellie's work and read his many articles at thenation.com. And is it both thenation.com or thenation.org? It's either one, right?
I only use .com. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Or I'm not,
very good.
I've never used
very
the
good. Fine. Okay. Supreme Court. I think we've gotten past the first question, which would have been, does it look like they're going to be involved in rulings regarding the 2020 election? I think our earlier conversation says not likely, and we sort of laid out why not.
Right.
Okay. Very briefly, what do you make of the last Supreme Court term? Before we just sort of what happened, and then we'll talk about the next one.
The one where RBG was still alive?
Yes.
Oh, that was an interesting one. There were a couple of cases last term that turned out a lot better than I had hoped, most notably the Bostock decision. So that was the question of whether the Civil Rights Act that protects against gender discrimination, whether that applied to sexual orientation discrimination, whether it applied to the LGBTQ community. And the Supreme Court said yes, and said yes 6-3, with Neil Gorsuch and John Roberts joining the then 4 liberals to make that case. That was a big victory, for a number of reasons. One, it's just factually true that a person who's being discriminated against because they're gay is also being discriminated against because of their gender, right? If it's okay for a man to love
right.
a woman, but not a woman to love a woman, well, then you're discriminating against a woman because she's a woman. So A, yay facts, but yay science. But B, just the horror of it being federally legal to mistreat and to fire people who are gay is really something that comes out of the 1980s that needed to be rejected soundly, and it was with a couple of Republicans. So that was a big big hawking win for the liberal side and for basic decency. Some other decisions, Roberts did his thing, and by Roberts doing his thing,
yes, yep.
What I mean is that he would side with the liberals in 5-4 decisions in such a way where technically the liberals won, but he laid landmines for future Republicans to come along and find and deploy, right? He laid the groundwork for bad things to happen in the future. So for instance, with the DACA case, now technically DACA was upheld by the court 5-4 with Roberts joining the liberals, saying that, as I mentioned before, Terrence, that Trump's attempt to end the program was arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay, that's technically a win. But he rejected what I thought was actually the best claim for DACA. It was, which wouldn't have been an APA claim, but would have been the equal protection claim, right? That the that by deporting people who have been brought out of the shadows was a violation of their 14th Amendment's rights to equal protection under the law. Roberts rejected that argument out of hand, which means that if Trump wins, we had won again. Or more likely, if, you know, in 2024 or 2028, a Republican wins, they can reject the program, just doing it without being arbitrary and capricious like Trump was.
That's right.
Right. So he's still allowed.
Yeah. I mean,
he allowed for the fundamental way for DACA to be rejected is still on the table. Roberts just didn't let Trump do it.
I mean, it seems like what you're describing about Roberts, if I've got it right, is that he finds a technical reason to not make these incredibly controversial decisions, but leaves it open for the next guy. Questions about standing, questions about here, about capricious rationalization, those sorts of things, so that he doesn't say the act is wrong or the whole notion is wrong, but we're just not going to let this one pass.
What I like to say about Roberts is that he bends the law towards the Republican agenda as far as he can without breaking it.
Mm-hmm.
That he cares about breaking it makes him different from the other Republicans.
Right.
Right. So I'll get
yeah.
to that.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, he is in it to win it for the Republican agenda just as much as any of the rest of them. He's just willing to go a little bit slower, to be a little bit more deliberate, to be a little bit more technical in the way that he's doing it.
Yeah.
It's what's really, you know, and it's one of the weird things. I know we're not quite talking about this yet, but it's one of the weird things about the Republicans' insistence on replacing RBG before the election, right? They didn't need to do that. They already had a 5-4 majority on the court. Last term proved how valuable a 5-4 majority on the court was for the Republican Party. The reason why they wanted a 6-3 majority is basically because Roberts was going too slow for them.
Yes!
If you think about it.
Yeah. Right?
Roberts wasn't shoving the Republican will down the people's throats quickly enough for these people, and that's why they wanted who became Amy Coney Barrett.
Right, and let me see, that Roberts' ability to do what he had been doing so far, and everyone, Linda Greenhouse, yourself, everyone, Marsha Coyle, everyone would say, this is clearly a Roberts court because he had that strategy. It's going to be much less likely for him to do that now, right?
It's going to be much harder.
Yeah.
And because I don't know that he has a friend on the Republican side. As I said, after RBG died, the swing, if you can believe this, the swing justice on the Supreme Court right now is Neil Gorsuch.
Hmm.
He's a Scalia clone. And the reason why Neil Gorsuch is a swing, and this is, you're going to hear the pejorativeness of my voice, but I can't help it. Gorsuch is the idiot that believes this stuff, right? Like the rest of the Republicans only use originalism or textualism or whatever they want to call it. They only use it to advance the Republican agenda. They kind of, you know, a guy like Brett Kavanaugh, a guy like Sam Alito, they kind of know that the reason why they're putting it in these terms is to get what they want. They understand that it's all a game. Gorsuch, he's like that problem that you have with second wave revolutionaries, right? He thinks that the revolution was real. That there are real principles there. But because Gorsuch has real principles that I cannot stand and could easily spend the rest of my life disagreeing with, but because they're actual principles and not simply kind of the bad
tactics,
faith argument
yeah.
tactic, right? He can be reasoned with is not the word that I would use, but he can be swayed. He
yes.
can be swayed because he actually believes in a set of principles.
Right. So he's not operating simply as an operative of the Republican Party. He's operating as a justice who believes something that favors the Republican point of view.
Gorsuch is not cynical. He's just wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. I want to talk about specific cases in the coming one, but let's talk. The thing I don't want to miss before we've run out of time is the question of balancing the court. With I'm using that term rather than packing the court. Just sort of, where do you stand? What do you think is needed, and what do you think is likely?
Look, I was for court packing before court packing was cool. I mean, I've been talking about court packing or court expansion or court balancing or however people want. I've been talking about that for 4 years at least. I mean, 4 years in print at least, and, you know, offline much longer than that. I think that there are great reasons to expand the court beyond the partisan issues. I think a larger court would be better for our entire system, because I think more justices would make it less important every time one of these people dies. I mean, one of our big problems with the Supreme Court right now is that every time one of these octogenarians passes away, which is a thing that happens, you know, it's not, shouldn't be a surprise when an 87-year-old woman dies. But every time one of these octogenarians passes away, it becomes an existential crisis for the party out of power because of the immense power each Supreme Court justice has. If you want to fix that, the easiest way to fix that is not taking away the power of the Supreme Court, but taking away the power of each individual justice. And the way to do that is by having more, right? So if we had 19 justices, if we had 29 justices, 29, by the way, is exactly how many judges the California Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has. So it's not like that's an unreasonable number. If we had 29 justices, every time a person died, it wouldn't be such of an all hands on deck, pants on fire crisis. So that's why I favor court expansion, which will clearly not happen, at least for two, right?
If they win the runoff if they win both runoffs in Georgia, it could, couldn't it?
No, I don't think you got, you always needed a margin, because you were never going to get Manchin all that easily.
Manchin. Yeah.
You know, like you right. were, and Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, like you were never going to get them easily.
And let me just tell people, Manchin, senator in West Virginia, and Sinema in Arizona, where we were talking before about winning congressional seats that are actually sort of Republican. That's kind of what we're talking about here with Manchin and Sinema, right?
Yeah, like they're not. You know, look, I'm happy to have. I'm one of those Democrats that is happy to have them in the party. If for no other reason than it kind of affects like who is in leadership positions.
Yeah.
But man, these are not reliable liberal votes by any
right.
stretch. And so you always were going to need a margin. And so even if you're at 50-50, I just don't see how that happens now. Again, if you could get to 50-50 now and then in 2022 get to 52-48, maybe it's back on the table. And also there's the issue of, and I never liked this strategy, but it's the world that we live in. Sometimes people need to see how bad a thing can be before they are willing to change it, right? And so there are people who think that a 6-3 Supreme Court, Republican-controlled Supreme Court, is survivable. Let's give them 2 years to see if they still think that.
Right. Because, a question I was going to ask was, you know, does the Merrick Garland the refusal to even consider Merrick Garland, and then the willingness to appoint a new one with 8 days, while people were already voting, with that might engage the public enough to move public opinion in favor of expanding the court. And what you're saying is probably, and a couple of really bad decisions by a 6-3 court would push that along.
I think so. Although, can I just say one more thing, Terrence?
Sure.
We're having this free-form conversation. Because it's important. I never get to talk about, you know, when I do spots on TV, it's always too short. I can never bring this up. It is important for people to remember that when it comes to packing and stacking the Supreme Court with Republicans, Mitch McConnell is willing to do it over the objection of public opinion.
That's right.
Brett Kavanaugh is the least popular Supreme Court justice since Gallup started tracking such numbers. All right? The public was overwhelmingly in favor of giving Merrick Garland a hearing. The public was overwhelmingly in favor of waiting until after the election to appoint Ruth Bader Ginsburg's replacement. McConnell don't care about polling when it comes to lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court. It's beyond annoying to me that the Democrats care about polling so much. So yes, I have an public opinion on court packing. I have arguments for how to move public opinion, and I can argue that we haven't really tried to, blah, blah. I can do all these polling arguments that you want me to do. But at the end of the day, why should that matter? If it's the right thing to do, this is the one area where Republicans are consistently willing to buck public opinion because they know how important the court is. Why aren't Democrats?
Hey, by the way, you said it's the one place. The public wasn't in favor of that tax bill either, and they had no trouble passing that.
That's a good point, right? Republicans don't care about your polls.
They don't!
Fundamentally, right?
They don't. They know that no one cares about what they're doing as much as they do.
And they know that they can, and they know that elections are a long time away. Like this argument that they're going to do so. If Republicans cared about the polls, we would have a coronavirus relief bill.
I'd say so. Yep. Oh gosh, Ellie, we're down to 2 minutes, and we haven't gotten into specific cases, which I guess is just yeah. Go ahead.
I can highlight one.
Give me your 2 minutes. Yeah.
All right, so the ACA case was argued in front of the Supreme Court last week. It went better than expected. I think there is a surprisingly good chance that Brett Kavanaugh joins John Roberts and the three surviving liberals and upholds the ACA on very limited grounds. But I think the ACA, well, as I wrote in The Nation, live to die another day.
Yes.
So that's good. But the case that did not go so well is this issue of Fulton County v. Philadelphia. It is an adoption case about whether or not the LGBTQ community in Pennsylvania will be allowed to adopt wards of the state, foster care, I should say, in Pennsylvania. And that went very, very poorly. And I think that case, the Fulton County case, is exactly the kind of theological conservatives that we now have on the Supreme Court. So whatever you think about kind of these rights or whatever, there's a theocraticness now to the Supreme Court. Fulton County will be your first opportunity to see it, but I fear we will see it a lot over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, in other words, the shift has happened from defending religious freedom on the rights of someone to practice their religion to defending religious freedom on the right to practice their religious bigotry.
It's gone from defending their rights to practice to imposing their dogma on other people.
That's right. And because we're so short on time, I'm going to read a great quote you made, which I think makes that point. You make the point that the issues in play before this court, this upcoming court, have been presented in a way that accepts as the beginning starting point Republican theories and priorities. You say we're debating religious freedom for Christians who want to be bigoted, not Muslims who want to worship unimpeded. We're debating Facebook's ability to conduct the internet equivalent of robocalls, not individual privacy rights on the platform. We're debating whether cops violate constitutional rights when they shoot unarmed people in the back who then get away, not whether cops will be arrested and charged with attempted murder for doing so. I'll give you the last word to just kind of buttress that one.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, when you have a 6-3 court, what you get are 6-3 cases, right? What you get are cases designed to play to that majority, that conservative majority, as opposed to designed to play to the middle. And that's what we're going to see again and again and again. We won't fully start feeling the effect of a 6-3 court for a couple of years because the cases aren't even in the pipeline yet that are designed to entice them.
That's right. In other words, what you're pointing out is it isn't just that cases arrive at the Supreme Court. It's the Supreme Court decides what cases to hear. And although we haven't even mentioned Roe v. Wade, the right has been looking for the correct cases to tee up for the Supreme Court to then accept and decide on that will allow them to make the rulings they want to make.
Exactly. And those cases are coming. Now that they know what they've got, those cases are coming.
Very good. Ellie, thanks a lot. This went fast and furious. Let me tell people, you can learn more and read all of Ellie's work, or just about all of Ellie's work, I guess, at thenation.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. That's terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones. And on my site, they're searchable. Often on podcast sites, they are not. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Ellie Mistel. Keep up your good work.
Thanks so much for having me.